12. False Gods for Lost Souls. 1. Parable Bears. Toward the end of 2017, National Geographic posted a video, set to sad music, of an emaciated and slow-moving polar bear to YouTube. "This is what climate change looks like," read the caption. A photojournalist and a filmmaker had filmed the bear the previous July. The video has been viewed at least 2.5 billion times. One of the viewers was student climate activist Greta Thunberg. "I remember when I was younger and in school, our teachers showed us films of plastic in the ocean, starving polar bears and so on," she recalled in spring 2019. "I cried through all the movies." Climate change is polar bears' greatest threat, concluded scientists in 2017, because it is melting the Arctic ice caps at a rate of 4% per year. But to hear climate denialists tell it, polar bears are doing just fine, reported the New York Times. Predictions about devastating declines in polar bear populations, they say, have failed to materialize. For 40 years, climate denialists, funded by fossil fuel companies, have misled the public about the science of climate change in the same way that tobacco companies misled the public about the science linking smoking and cancer, argued Harvard historians of science Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway in their influential 2010 book, Merchants of Doubt. The book is one of the most cited sources as proof that political inaction on climate change is due to climate science skepticism promoted by right-wing think tanks funded by fossil fuel interests. A critical moment in the history of climate denial came in 1983, Oreskes and Conway argue, when the National Academy of Sciences published its first major report on climate change. The result, Changing Climate, report of the Carbon Dioxide Assessment Committee, was really two reports, they write. Five chapters detailing the likelihood of anthropogenic climate change written by natural scientists, and two chapters on emissions and climate impacts by economists, which presented very different impressions of the problem. The synthesis sided with the economists, not the natural scientists. Right-wingers had effectively hijacked the National Academy of Sciences, they argue, which the U.S. government created in 1863 to objectively evaluate scientific questions for policymakers. William Nierenberg, who chaired the National Academy of Sciences Carbon Dioxide Assessment Committee, was a political conservative who trampled over the views of natural scientists like John Perry, a meteorologist, who had concluded, "The problem is already upon us." Oreskes and Conway write, "Perry would be proven right, but economist Thomas Schelling's view would prevail politically. Indeed, it provided the kernel of the emerging idea that climate skeptics would echo for the next three decades, that we could continue to burn fossil fuels without restriction and deal with the consequences through migration and adaptation." Schelling's argument, they said, was equivalent to arguing that medical researchers shouldn't try to cure cancer, because that would be too expensive, and in any case, people in the future might decide that dying from cancer is not so bad. But what economist Schelling argued about climate change was in no way similar to the tobacco industry's denial of the link between smoking and cancer. Nor was he saying the climate equivalent of dying from cancer is not so bad. In fact, his argument rested upon acknowledgement that emissions were warming the planet and could be harmful. Schelling's view was simply that the effects of restricting energy consumption could be worse than the effects of global warming. That view was mainstream back then and remains so today. Indeed, it is at the heart of the discussions of climate mitigation in reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, and the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, and other scientific bodies. And rather than being similar to a tobacco industry scientist, Schelling is widely considered one of the most brilliant and humanistic economists of the 20th century. As a professor at Harvard, Schelling received the Nobel Prize in 2005 for his pioneering work on everything from preventing nuclear war to ending racial discrimination. The author of the summary, which Oreskes and Conway claim sided with the economists, was Jesse Ossible, the expert in energy transitions who worked with Cesare Marchetti in the 1970s at the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis, IASA, in Vienna. Ossible also co-authored an article with Yale University's William Nordhaus, who won the Nobel Prize in 2018 for his work on the economics of climate change. In other words, there was nothing right-wing or climate denialist at all about changing climate. The New York Times thought so highly of the report that it reprinted its entire four-page summary. Moreover, the framework Ossible, Nordhaus, and Schelling developed became the basis for much of the scientific and analytical work of the IPCC. As for the scientist John Perry, he flatly rejected the version of events presented by Oreskes and Conway. "You assert that the members of the committee did not concur with the synthesis," he wrote in a 2007 email to Oreskes. However, he said, "I would never have permitted the report to go forward if any member had raised explicit objections." Perry added, "It seems to me that you are evaluating a report of 1983 in terms of the received wisdom of 2007. Nirenberg's strong support for a broad and vigorous research program was very welcome, and I don't recall any bitter complaints about his softness on immediate policy actions." But Oreskes and Conway were apparently unfazed by Perry's rejection of their narrative because they published their fable unchanged. What about the polar bears? The climate denialists were right. Devastating declines in the number of polar bears have indeed failed to materialize, which was something the creators of the starving polar bear footage were forced to admit. "National Geographic went too far with the caption," said one of them, seeking to shift the blame. But the primary purpose of her expedition was to link dying polar bears to climate change. "Documenting the effects of climate change on wildlife hasn't been easy," she added. "But the reason it wasn't easy is that there was no evidence for polar bear famine. Of the 19 subpopulations, 2 increased, 4 decreased, 5 are stable, and 8 have never been counted. There is no discernible overall trend." It is possible that sea ice's decline is making the polar bear population smaller than it would otherwise be, but even if it were, other factors may be having a larger impact. Hunting, for one, killed 53,500 polar bears between 1963 and 2016, an amount twice as large as today's estimated total population of 26,000. As for fossil fuel-funded climate denialists misleading people about polar bears, we couldn't find any. The main critic of polar bear exaggerations is a zoologist in Canada named Susan Crockford, who told me that she neither accepts money from fossil fuel interests nor denies that the planet is warming due to human activities. As such, the misinformation about polar bears perfectly captures the ways in which many of the stories people tell about climate change don't have much to do with science. 2. Climate politics takes its toll. As a university student in the Netherlands, Richard Toll was a member of both Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth. Concerned about climate change, he earned a PhD in economics in 1997. And delved into the then-emerging field of economics of climate change with gusto, becoming one of the most cited economists in the world on the topic. Now a professor at the University of Sussex in Britain, Toll became involved with the IPCC shortly after it was created, in 1994. He played a major role in all three working groups, science, mitigation, and adaptation. Toll's reputation came in part from being on a team that rigorously established that carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases are warming the planet. "We were the first to show that in a statistically sound way," he says. Toll doesn't look like a typical economics professor. When I first met him in London a few years back, His t-shirt was untucked, he was wearing a trench coat, and his hair and beard were long and frizzy, as though he had just stuck a fork in an electric socket. In 2012, Toll was named the convening lead author of one of the chapters in the IPCC's Fifth Review of Climate Change, a prestigious position reflective of his expertise and respect from his peers. He was assigned to the team to draft the IPCC's Summary for Policymakers, which is often the only version of the report most journalists, politicians, and informed members of the public read. The summary authors are charged with distilling key messages into 44 pages, even though everyone knows that policy and media will only pick up a few sentences, Toll says. This leads to a contest between authors of chapters. My impact is worst, so I will get the headlines. Toll said that the primary message of an earlier draft of the summary was the same one I've emphasized with regards to the Congo. Many of the more worrying impacts of climate change are really symptoms of mismanagement and underdevelopment. But representatives from European nations wanted the report's focus to be on emissions reductions, not economic development. IPCC is partly a scientific organization and partly a political organization, Toll explained. As a political organization, its job is to justify greenhouse gas emissions reduction. The summary was written during a week-long meeting in Yokohama, Japan. Some of these delegates are scholars, others are not, Toll explained. The Irish delegate, for instance, thinks that unmitigated climate change would put us on a highway to hell, referring, I believe, to an AC/DC song rather than a learned paper. 2 years later, despite Toll's protests, IPCC approved a summary for policymakers that was far more apocalyptic than the science warranted. The IPCC shifted from not without risk but manageable to we're all gonna die, explained Toll. It was a shift, he said, from what I think is a relatively accurate assessment of recent developments in literature to the four horsemen of the apocalypse, pestilence, death, famine, and war were all there. IPCC's summary left out key information, Toll alleges. The summary omits that better cultivars and improved irrigation increase crop yields. It shows the impact of sea level rise on the most vulnerable country, but does not mention the average. It emphasizes the impacts of increased heat stress, but downplays reduced cold stress. It warns about poverty traps, violent conflict, and mass migration without much support in the literature. The media, of course, exaggerated further. It wasn't the first time IPCC had exaggerated climate change's impact in a summary. In 2010, an IPCC summary falsely claimed climate change would result in the melting of the Himalayan glaciers by 2035. This was a serious case of alarmism, given that 800 million people depend on the glaciers for irrigation and drinking water. Shortly after, four scientists published a letter in Science pointing out the error, with one of them calling it extremely embarrassing and damaging, adding, "These errors could have been avoided had the norms of scientific publication, including peer review and concentration upon peer-reviewed work, been respected." Roger Pilkey, the University of Colorado expert on climate change and natural disasters, similarly found instances where IPCC authors were exaggerating or misrepresenting the science for effect. What does Pilkey think about this? An external IPCC reviewer at one point asked about a claim being made about climate change and natural disasters. The official IPCC response was, "I believe Pilkey agrees." But he didn't. Indeed, he had never been consulted. The IPCC included misleading information in its report, Pilkey said, and then fabricated a response to a reviewer who identified the misleading information to justify keeping that material in the report. Thanks in part to the criticisms of IPCC by Pilkey and other scientists, environment ministers from around the world demanded an independent review of IPCC policies and procedures by the Inter-Academy Council, the International Organization of National Science Academies. The Inter-Academy Council made recommendations for improving research quality that IPCC adopted, such as better practices for including research that had not yet been published in peer-reviewed journals. But the IPCC kept publishing apocalyptic summaries and press releases, and IPCC contributors and lead authors kept making apocalyptic claims, such as that sea level rise will be unmanageable and that the potential risk of multi-breadbasket failure is increasing. And, as Toll noted, journalists exaggerated further. The system appeared biased toward exaggeration. Aucible was one of the first to recognize the politicization of climate science. After pioneering ways to forecast energy demand, transitions, and emissions for changing climate, he helped create the IPCC. And then the expected happened, Aucible said. Opportunists flowed in. By 1992, I stopped wanting to go to climate meetings. In response to the IPCC's decision to let the exaggerators write the summary for policymakers, Toll resigned. I simply thought it was incredible, he said. I told Chris Field, the chairman, about this, and I quietly withdrew. This book began with a defense of the science assembled by IPCC and others against those who claim climate change will be apocalyptic. We saw how the scientific consensus, as reflected in IPCC reports, supports Toll's view that many of the more worrying impacts of climate change are really symptoms of mismanagement and underdevelopment. Now we must address the question of how so many people, myself included, came to believe that climate change threatened not only the end of polar bears, but the end of humanity. The answer is, in part, that while the IPCC's science is broadly sound, its summary for policymakers, press releases, and authors' statements betray ideological motivations, a tendency toward exaggeration, and an absence of important context. As we saw, IPCC authors and press statements have claimed sea level rise will be unmanageable, world food supplies are in jeopardy, vegetarianism would significantly reduce emissions, poor nations can grow rich with renewables, and nuclear energy is relatively dangerous. The news media also deserves blame for having misrepresented climate change and other environmental problems as apocalyptic, and for having failed to put them in their global, historical, and economic context. Leading media companies have been exaggerating climate change at least since the 1980s. And as we have seen, elite publications like the New York Times and the New Yorker have frequently and uncritically repeated debunked Malthusian dogma for well more than a half century. The IPCC and other scientific organizations are most misleading in what their summaries and press releases don't say, or at least not clearly. They don't clearly say that the death toll from natural disasters has radically declined and should decline further with continued adaptation. They don't clearly say that wood fuel buildup and constructing homes near forests matters more than climate change in determining the severity and impact of fires in much of the world. And they don't clearly say that fertilizer, tractors, and irrigation matter more than climate change to crop yields. 3. Who framed Roger Pielke? In early 2015, Raul Grijalva, a U.S. congressman from Arizona, sent a letter to the University of Colorado's president suggesting that Roger Pielke might have taken money from the fossil fuel industry. Grijalva offered no evidence Pielke had taken fossil fuel money, but noted that a different scientist, one who is skeptical of climate change, had received funding from an electric utility that operates fossil fuel power plants, and hinted that Pielke might have done the same. Grijalva asked the university's president to hand over any and all of Pielke's correspondence relating to his recent congressional testimony, as well as all government testimony he had ever given, including in draft form. And he demanded documents showing Pielke's funding sources. Meanwhile, ExxonMobil, Grijalva wrote, may have provided false or misleading information about its support for a scientist in the past. If true, these may not be isolated incidents, wrote Grijalva, who posted the letter to his website and distributed it to reporters. The result was widespread media coverage of Grijalva's implied accusation that Pilkey might be secretly taking money from Exxon. Grijalva sent similar letters to six other university presidents whose schools employed scientists who testified in front of Congress about climate change. It was hardly the first time progressives had attacked Pilkey. Starting in 2008, seven separate authors with Center for American Progress, CAP, the large progressive think tank, had published more than 150 blog posts attacking Pilkey as the Uber denier and a trickster and a careerist. Roger Pilkey is the single most disputed and debunked person in the entire realm of people who publish regularly on disasters and climate change, claimed a CAP spokesperson. Center for American Progress was able to persuade many in the news media that Pilkey was a climate skeptic. In 2010, the magazine Foreign Policy included Pilkey in an article titled The FP Guide to Climate Skeptics and wrote, for his work questioning certain graphs presented in IPCC reports, Pilkey has been accused by some of being a climate change denier. After learning of the investigation, Pilkey responded with a blog post on his website. I am under investigation, reads the headline. Before continuing, let me make one point abundantly clear. I have no funding, declared or undeclared, with any fossil fuel company or interest. I never have. In January 2014, John Podesta, the founder of the Center for American Progress, who oversaw aspects of the 2009 Green Stimulus and the effort to pass cap-and-trade legislation, took a position in the White House, where he oversaw climate change policy and communications. A few days after Podesta's appointment, John Holdren, a senior advisor and director of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy under President Barack Obama, emailed him to say, I'm looking forward to working with you on the president's climate change agenda. In February 2014, Holdren appeared in front of the same Senate committee that Pilkey had testified before a year earlier. A senator asked Holdren about Pilkey's earlier testimony. Holdren replied that Pilkey's research was not representative of the mainstream scientific opinion. A few days later, Holdren published a 3,000-word article on the White House website criticizing Pilkey's testimony before Congress as misleading and not representative of mainstream views. But Grijalva's attack on Pilkey had crossed a line, even for most activist scientists and journalists. When politicians seek to probe beyond possible sources of external influence on published work and attempt to expose internal discussions that they find inconvenient, editorialized the British journal Nature about the investigation, that sends a chilling message to all academics and to the wider public. Publicly singling out specific researchers based on perspectives they have expressed and implying a failure to appropriately disclose funding sources and thereby questioning their scientific integrity, wrote the American Meteorological Society in a public statement, sends a chilling message to all academic researchers. Eventually, Grijalva backed down, at least partially. He admitted to a reporter that his request for Pilkey's correspondence was overreach. He said, as long as we get a response as to the funding sources, I think everything else is secondary and not necessary. While other university presidents ignored Grijalva's request, the then University of Colorado president cooperated and investigated Pilkey. The resulting investigation confirmed that Pilkey had never received any funding from fossil fuel companies. The effort to delegitimize Pilkey was one of the most audacious and effective attacks by a fossil fuel-funded think tank on a climate expert in history. It can be partly explained by the financial interests of CAP's donors. As we saw, renewable energy and natural gas interests funded CAP during the period when CAP was overseeing both Obama's green stimulus program and the administration's effort to pass cap and trade climate legislation in Congress between 2009 and 2010. It can also be partly explained by politics. Some people told me that the campaign of character assassination against Pielke was due to the widespread belief among Democratic, progressive, and environmental leaders that they needed to be able to claim that climate change's impacts are happening right now and are catastrophic in order to pass legislation to subsidize renewables and tax fossil fuels and recruit, mobilize, and win over swing voters. But having lived through the period, I perceived that his persecution seemed to go well beyond money and political power. It felt like a witch hunt, a term we apply to campaigns like Senator Joseph McCarthy's persecution of scientists and artists as alleged communists in the 1950s. The scapegoating of Pielke, like apocalyptic environmentalism more broadly, had an undeniably religious quality to it. 4. False gods. In 2019, Bill McKibben published a new book, Falter, which argued that climate change is the greatest challenge humans have ever faced. It was a strong claim by America's leading environment writer and most influential climate leader. McKibben writes for The New Yorker and The New York Times, and his organization, 350.org, has a nearly $20 million annual budget. He is respected by other journalists, members of Congress, presidential candidates, and millions of Americans. As such, it is worth taking his claim seriously. As we have seen, the death toll and damage from extreme events have declined 90% during the last century, including in poor nations. For McKibben's argument to be true, that long salutary trend will need to reverse itself, and quickly. And, for McKibben's claim to be true, climate change must prove to be a greater challenge than coping with the Black Death, which killed about half of all Europeans, about 50 million people, the control of infectious diseases, which killed hundreds of millions, the Great Wars of Europe and the Holocaust, which killed more than 100 million people, post-war independence movements, and the spread of nuclear weapons, and Africa's world wars, which killed millions of people. And climate change must prove to be greater than all other contemporary challenges, from the monumental task of lifting 1 billion souls out of extreme poverty in a world where manufacturing is playing a smaller role in economic development, to the battles and wars that killed tens of thousands of people last year in the Middle East and Africa. McKibben's apocalyptic vision didn't start with climate change. In 1971, when Bill McKibben was 11 years old, police arrested his father for defending the right of Vietnam veterans against the war to gather on the town green in Lexington, Massachusetts. McKibben's mother says her son was furious that he wasn't allowed to be arrested with his father. Later, McKibben protested nuclear power himself, and he was tear-gassed for it. After Harvard, McKibben says his leftism grew more righteous. He was influenced by New Yorker writer Jonathan Schell, who wrote books claiming humankind had to get rid of nuclear weapons or risk extinction. In his 1989 The End of Nature, he described climate change as an apocalyptic threat like nuclear war. The underlying problem, said McKibben, was spiritual. Through capitalist industrialization, humankind had lost its connection to nature. We can no longer imagine that we are part of something larger than ourselves, he wrote in The End of Nature. That is what this all boils down to. In the early 20th century, the American scholar William James defined religion as the belief in an unseen order and that our supreme good lies in adjusting ourselves thereto. The scholar Paul Tillich defined religion more broadly, to include belief systems and moral frameworks. For environmentalists, the unseen order we need to adjust ourselves to is nature. Throughout this book, we have seen environmental support for various behaviors, technologies, and policies, motivated not by what the science tells us, but by intuitive views of nature. These intuitive views rest on the appeal to nature fallacy. The appeal to nature fallacy holds that natural things, for example, tortoiseshell, ivory, wild fish, organic fertilizer, wood fuel, and solar farms, are better for people and the environment than artificial things, for example, plastics from fossil fuels, farmed fish, chemical fertilizer, and nuclear plants. It is fallacious for two reasons. First, the artificial things are as natural as the natural things. They are simply newer. Second, the older, natural things are bad, not good, if good is defined as protecting sea turtles, elephants, and wild fish. This background and largely unconscious idea of nature is, in my experience, very strong. I have seen many environmentalists dismiss evidence demonstrating, for example, the larger impact of renewable energy and organic farming on landscapes. Natural things must, by definition, be better for the environment. Irrational ideas about nature repeatedly creep into the environmental sciences. In the 1940s, scientists attempted to create a science of nature, ecology, which was based on cybernetics, the science of self-regulating systems, which had been usefully applied in World War II for guiding anti-aircraft missiles. Cybernetics also applies to systems like thermostats, which turn on the furnace when it gets too cold and turn it off when it gets too hot. The assumption was that nature, when left alone, achieves a kind of harmony or equilibrium, like the thermostat switching on in the cold. Nature gracefully, gradually self-regulates species and environments in and out of existence when it senses things are out of proportion. It's an interwoven system that works as a whole unless humans interfere with its operations. But nature doesn't operate like a self-regulating system. In reality, different natural environments change constantly. Species come and go. There is no whole or system to collapse. There's just a changing mix of plants, animals, and other organisms over time. We might prefer one version of that mixture, like the Amazon rainforest, but there is nothing in the mixture telling us that it is better or worse than some other combination, like a farm or desert. The same is true for what we call the climate. The climate simply refers to the weather over a period of time, say 30 years. Either in a particular place or the entire planet. In reality, much of what we see in the climate and Earth systems are dials, like higher temperatures and rising sea levels, not switches, like sudden ice sheet melting or forests burning out of control. Apocalyptic scientists and activists list various changes, such as melting ice sheets, changing ocean circulations, and deforestation. And suggest that they will add up to an apocalyptic sum greater than their parts, but they cannot offer a clear mechanism, amidst so much complexity and uncertainty, for how such an apocalyptic scenario could occur. While scientists borrowed from cybernetics to describe nature as a self-regulating system, the notion of nature existing in a delicate balance is Neoplatonism and ungrounded in empirical reality. The commonplaces of modern ecology, such as everything connects, writes environmental philosopher Mark Sagoff, recalls the Neoplatonic view of nature as an integrated mechanism into which every species fits. Some ecological scientists recognized that they had inadvertently and unconsciously imposed a fundamentally religious idea onto science. I am convinced that modern ecological theory, so important in our attitudes towards nature and man's interference with it, admitted one, owes its origin to the Judeo-Christian intelligent design argument. The wisdom of the Creator is self-evident, no living thing is useless, and all are related one to the other. The flip side of nature's interconnectedness was collapse, which E.O. Wilson adopted as the core assumption of his apocalyptic species area model. What the scientists had recreated in both the species area model and the prediction that extinctions would result in the extinction of humankind were the first and last book of the Bible. Genesis tells the story of Eden and humankind's fall from it as a consequence of its hubris. The book of Revelation tells the story of the end of the world, the ultimate consequence of humankind's fall. Environmentalism today is the dominant secular religion of the educated upper-middle-class elite in most developed and many developing nations. It provides a new story about our collective and individual purpose. It designates good guys and bad guys, heroes and villains, and it does so in the language of science, which provides it with legitimacy. On the one hand, environmentalism and its sister religion, vegetarianism, appear to be a radical break from the Judeo-Christian religious tradition. For starters, environmentalists themselves do not tend to be believers or strong believers in Judeo-Christianity. In particular, environmentalists reject the view that humans have or should have dominion or control over Earth. On the other hand, apocalyptic environmentalism is a kind of new Judeo-Christian religion, one that has replaced God with nature. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, human problems stem from our failure to adjust ourselves to God. In the apocalyptic environmental tradition, human problems stem from our failure to adjust ourselves to nature. In some Judeo-Christian traditions, priests play the role of interpreting God's will or laws, including discerning right from wrong. In the apocalyptic environmentalist tradition, scientists play that role. "I want you to listen to the scientists," Thunberg and others repeat. Most environmentalists are unaware that they are repeating Judeo-Christian myths, concludes a scholar who studied the phenomenon closely, because Judeo-Christian myths and morals are prevalent in our culture. Environmentalists know them subconsciously and repeat them unintentionally, albeit in the ostensibly secular language of science and nature. Having first experienced and then studied the phenomenon for 15 years, I believe that secular people are attracted to apocalyptic environmentalism because it meets some of the same psychological and spiritual needs as Judeo-Christianity and other religions. Apocalyptic environmentalism gives people a purpose to save the world from climate change or some other environmental disaster. It provides people with a story that casts them as heroes, which some scholars, as we will see, believe we need in order to find meaning in our lives. At the same time, apocalyptic environmentalism does all of this while retaining the illusion among its adherents that they are people of science and reason, not superstition and fantasy. "For the many people skeptical of institutional Christian religion," wrote a leading scholar, "but seeking greater religious meaning in their lives, that is no doubt part of the attraction of secular religion." There is nothing wrong with religions, and often a great deal right about them. They have long provided people with the meaning and purpose they need, particularly in order to survive life's many challenges. Religions can be a guide to positive, pro-social, and ethical behavior. "Whether or not God exists, and as an atheist I personally doubt it," noted psychologist Jonathan Hyde, "religious believers in the United States are happier, healthier, longer-lived, and more generous to charity and to each other than our secular people." The trouble with the new environmental religion is that it has become increasingly apocalyptic, destructive, and self-defeating. It leads its adherents to demonize their opponents, often hypocritically. It drives them to seek to restrict power and prosperity at home and abroad, and it spreads anxiety and depression without meeting the deeper psychological, existential, and spiritual needs its ostensibly secular devotees seek. 5. Apocalypse Angst. To believe in imminent apocalypse is, according to one scholar, to believe that the accepted texture of reality is about to undergo a staggering transformation, in which the long-established institutions and ways of life will be destroyed. And to some extent, that is what is happening, and has been happening since the end of the Cold War, World War II, the rise of the scientific and industrial revolutions. For thousands of years, religions sought to constrain what we today call science, efforts to understand the world, including ourselves. Even Sir Francis Bacon, the father of modern physics, wrote in 1605 that the pursuit of knowledge outside of morality was dangerous. After the rediscovery of classical texts, including Plato and Aristotle in the Middle Ages, Western thinkers initially concentrated on reconciling classical philosophy with Christianity. Over time, however, the focus shifted to making sense of the natural world, leading to what is called the scientific revolution. Although most early scientists professed that they did their science in service of God, they pursued knowledge without knowing whether it would lead to good or ill. And privately, they saw that their experiments worked the same whether or not they were pious. During the Enlightenment, philosophers tried to apply the same rational approach to morality and politics in the form of secular humanism. It borrowed from Judeo-Christianity the idea that humans were special, but it emphasized the use of science and reason in the pursuit of virtue and did not require belief in God, the afterlife, or other core aspects of religion. Politically, secular humanists believed in the fundamental equality of all human beings. But it quickly became clear there was no objective basis for morality. In the 1800s, philosophers pointed out all the ways in which what we believe to be good is based on our own selfish needs and changing historical and social contexts. Morality, it turned out, was relative to your time, place, and social position. By the 1920s, European philosophers argued that moral judgments could not be justified empirically and were simply expressions of emotion, which have no specific content and are thus meaningless. We couldn't start deciding what was right or wrong based on what made particular people sad or happy at any given moment. After World War II, many leading scholars and universities in Europe and the United States rejected the teaching of morality and virtue as unscientific and thus without value. Reason reveals life to be without purpose or meaning, was the intellectual consensus, a historian notes. Science is the only legitimate exercise of the intellect, but that leads inevitably to technology and ultimately to the bomb. From humanists, we learned that science threatens civilization, the historian added. From the scientists, we learned that science cannot be stopped. Taken together, they implied there is no hope. The result, he argued, was a culture of despair. Apocalyptic environmentalism emerged from this crisis of faith and, over the decades, became pronounced during moments of global change and crisis. In 1970, when fears of overpopulation were at their peak, Earth Day was held in the midst of national turmoil over the Vietnam War. In 1983, during heightened Cold War tensions, more than 300,000 people protested in London's Hyde Park against nuclear weapons. And in the early 1990s, climate change emerged as the new apocalyptic threat at the end of the Cold War. After the dissolution of the Soviet Union, people in the West no longer had an external enemy against which to direct their negative energy and define themselves. Being the sole winner in a conflict means concentrating on oneself all the criticism that could earlier be deflected onto others, observed Pascal Bruckner in The Fanaticism of the Apocalypse. In the wake of the 2016 elections in Britain and the United States, where voters rejected in one way or another the established global order, climate alarmism grew more extreme. Where environmentalism had until recently offered the prospects of utopia in the form of a return to low-energy and renewable-powered agrarian societies, it is striking the extent to which apocalyptic environmentalist leaders have de-emphasized that vision for an emphasis on climate Armageddon. Green utopianism is still there, apocalyptic environmentalists in Europe and the United States advocate a Green New Deal, not just to reduce carbon emissions, but also to create good jobs with high pay, reduce economic inequality, and improve community life. But negativity has triumphed over positivity. In place of love, forgiveness, kindness, and the kingdom of heaven, today's apocalyptic environmentalism offers fear, anger, and the narrow prospects of avoiding extinction. I happened to be in London to witness Extinction Rebellion's forcible closure of central London, which was about a week before the Tube protest. I stayed in a hotel a few blocks from Trafalgar Square, where hundreds of activists camped out for 2 weeks. The mostly white, educated, upper-middle-class Extinction Rebellion activists were strikingly similar in socioeconomic status, ideology, and behavior to the Earth First activists I'd met while working to save the last unprotected ancient redwood forest in Northern California in the late 1990s. But Extinction Rebellion was far more death-obsessed than Earth First. At London Fashion Week, there were Extinction Rebellion activists carrying coffins. There were large banners with the word death on them. There were women wearing black mourning veils, and there were dead silent activists wearing blood-red gowns who had painted their faces ghost white, save for their red lips. Extinction Rebellion's heavy focus on death bothered me, and so, after I returned to the United States, I reached out to my friend Richard Rhodes, the author of The Making of the Atomic Bomb. Dick and I had talked about death earlier in the year, and so I was curious to hear his reaction to the ubiquity of death symbolism in Extinction Rebellion's protests. "You know Becker's book, The Denial of Death?" Rhodes asked. "It won the Pulitzer Prize." I said I did. According to the anthropologist Ernest Becker, all humans, not just religious people, need to believe, consciously or unconsciously, that we are, in one way or another, immortal, that some part of us will never die. "Humans are unique," Becker believed, "in that we realize that we are going to die from a very young age. Our deaths rightly frighten us. We are all born with strong survival instincts. But since too much fear of death gets in the way of living, healthy individuals repress their fears, making them mostly unconscious. To defend ourselves psychologically against this low-level fear, we create what Becker calls an immortality project, a way of feeling that some part of us will live on after our deaths. Many people feel immortal by having children and grandchildren. Others feel immortal creating art, businesses, writing, or communities that will last after they are gone. We subconsciously cast ourselves as the heroes of our immortality projects. It doesn't matter whether the cultural hero is magical, religious, and primitive, or secular, scientific, and civilized," Becker wrote. "It is still a mythical hero system in which people serve in order to earn a feeling of primary value, of cosmic specialness, of ultimate usefulness to creation, of unshakable meaning. Such appear to be the benefits of climate activism. Extinction Rebellion, Sarah Lunnan told me, offered a way of being courageous. Zion Lights of Extinction Rebellion pointed to research showing children who engage with climate activism have better mental health than kids who know about climate change but don't do anything about it. And Thunberg's climate activism allowed her to escape depression. It is like day and night," said her father. "It is an incredible transformation." There was much to admire in the idealism of environmentalism and vegetarianism, which are popular among adolescents and young adults. They represent the will to give a future to the entire planet, including its animals, conclude the Italian psychologists who studied vegetarian beliefs. But vegetarianism also appears to stem from above-average existential angst. The fear of death may be recognized as inherent not only to single individuals, write the Italians, but as the connotation of an ecological ethics which expresses itself through vegetarianism. For Becker, an exaggerated fear of death reveals a deep and often subconscious dissatisfaction with one's life. What we really fear when we obsess over our death is that we aren't making the most of our lives. We feel stuck in bad relationships, unsupportive communities, or oppressive careers. That was certainly the case for me. I was drawn toward the apocalyptic view of climate change 20 years ago. I can see now that my heightened anxiety about climate change reflected underlying anxiety and unhappiness in my own life that had little to do with climate change or the state of the natural environment. Perhaps it is a coincidence, but it is notable that the spike in environmental alarmism comes at a time when anxiety, depression, and suicide are rising within the general population, especially among adolescents, in both the United States and Europe. 70% of American teenagers call anxiety and depression a major problem. Because addressing our personal lives is painful and difficult, suggests Becker, we often look for external demons to conquer. Doing so makes us feel heroic and creates a feeling of immortality through the recognition, validation, and love we receive from others.